Tiny Boys Talks with me, Tori Bono. And today I am delighted to be talking about one of my favourite things, questioning. And I am joined by Ross McGill, who is going to share all the research and understanding that he has about how to get questioning right in the classroom. So welcome to Tiny Boys Talks, Ross.
Thank you, Toria, for having me. Hello, everybody listening.
I'm so excited that you're here. I mean, it's, you know, I've got to say, like, I've listened to you, I've been to your talks, and to actually have you on the podcast to share this, well, it's wisdom, but it's also research. You've done so much, haven't you?
I have.
Before I go on, I should say, who is Ross McGill? For those that don't know, although I'm pretty sure most people do.
Well, there's always one or two. There's a lot of people in the world. So I've been a teacher for, well, I was a teacher for 25 years, secondary qualified, design and technology. My last role was vice principal in a large secondary school in London, 2,000 kids, 250 staff, managing and supporting everyone in that organization was a real blessing, but also a challenge. At the same time, I was also blogging as Teacher Toolkit. I think I was in my 15th year at the time of that last role. So now the blog is, 15 plus years old now, so 19 million readers. So it became a full-time job on top of the day job, and it was getting difficult to manage both. But the blog all started as a hobby, and it's become an accidental business stroke me also working with teachers in schools all across the world and physically and online. And I guess it's just led to me putting things into print, such as the book. So I've just signed book 12 contract today. So you can have an exclusive. It's called Guide to Feedback. Until people say they don't enjoy it anymore, I'll stop doing it. But the website is getting busier and busier, and people accessing resources and content all the time. About 50,000 visitors a week, which is a quiet week, but that's roughly where all the statistics are at the moment.
I mean, there's just immense amounts on that. I genuinely don't know when you sleep because you put so much content on that.
Yeah, well, I've gone through the highs and lows and, you know, workload and all those kind of journeys. I am blogging less, actually. It's probably one or two blogs a week. But if I think about, you know, I've always used my microphone technology for a long time, well before AI. So I was used to just speak into my computer and my voice would type it up for me. So that's why I've managed to write so much content. I've been doing that now for probably 10 years. So that's allowed me to articulate and document things much quicker than other people, which might be not so transparent to other people. But actually in the blog, I've always written about how I've managed to do this, because in the early days, I used to get a lot of criticism about how does he sustain being a dad, a deputy head and a blogger and do them all quite well. Well, that's a very good question, but that's one of the secrets. So.
And actually, it's really interesting looking at the book. Your love of technology comes across.
Yeah, I've always loved my technology. I'm definitely not consumed by it, but then I look at all the gadgets around me here on my desk, and maybe I'm telling the porky, but I've always loved integrating technology where I can in the classroom, knowing full well that sometimes your technology can be quite easily out of date, or school networks don't allow you to fulfill their kind of full potential. So I've always been curious, and I've always tried to see where I could use it in my personal life, as well as blogging, as well as in the classroom. I've been sharing QR codes for a good 10 years now, but now everyone's got QR codes on their phone. They're all back in rage now. So that's good for me, because I've been sharing that kind of technology. It's just a nice, easy way for people to take ideas and things a little bit further. So an example would be for teachers listening is, you know, if you've got parents coming into your school to look around the school, but there's no kids in the classroom, zap the QR code and then they can see the classroom full of kids. It's such an easy way to bring things to life. So, you know, that's one example of millions of ways to use technology to really improve engagement.
Now, you've referred to yourself as curious, and it was really interesting. When I was reading the book, and this is, what number book is this one?
That is book number 11.
Book number 11, Guide to Questioning. And when I was reading it, I wrote down, he's so inquisitive. Because what I found fascinating is and I don't know the way your brain works, but I'm just going to guess for a moment, that you sort of, you're thinking about something, and then you go, oh, I'd love to know a little bit more about that. And then you go down this research road, and then you go, oh, actually, I want to learn a little bit more about it. And you go down that research road, because the guide to questioning is filled with research. Am I right about the way your brain works?
It's a good question. I'm always getting told off for being a little bit scatty. So in my older age, I'm trying harder to consciously go a little slower and to stay focused, to listen very carefully to what's being said, you know, to maintain that kind of eye contact. Because at the same time, all of us, our brains are whizzing at a million miles an hour, thinking of all the other things, you know, all those distractions, you know, what am I having for dinner tonight? What do I need to do tomorrow? When's the next deadline due? So you have all these background distractions. It's very hard to be consciously in the moment and to really truly focus. So I guess when I'm writing a book, I mean, I have easily 10 to 20,000 words cut out of the final book. I'll easily draft 40, 50,000 words. So what my brilliant editors managed to do is simplify it as much as possible, try and keep it coherent. And I guess this kind of guide to methodology that we've got in the book, it works really nice for teachers because it's a nice target size set of ideas. You can read each chapter in isolation. Each chapter is probably less than 5,000 words, so you could read a chapter in less than 10 minutes. It's perfect for teachers. And I guess one thing worth mentioning is the analytics from my website. For over a decade, I've always used them to guide me. Despite 90 million people reading the site, the average reading time has always been just 72 seconds, which is approximately 400 words per minute. So that if that's just on average how we consume information, then that's a good way to then reproduce information for others. So, yeah, that inquisitiveness about trying to always be better, trying to learn, trying to follow my own passions, but as well as meet the needs of people that I want to help. I guess that's maybe why you've come up with a summary inquisitiveness, but I might say busy or scatty or something like that. But it's a good summary.
What I found was your inquisitive nature just led me deeper and deeper and deeper into my understanding of questioning.
Yeah, I think that's all I've done. I've been a teacher my entire life. It's all I ever know. And I guess as you get a bit wiser, people start to want to know your ideas or ask you to come and lead some training for them. So you're kind of giving back in other ways. So I guess I'm now in a privileged position where I am asked to come into schools, share my wisdom with other teachers, and in every situation I'm learning something even more about all the different scenarios that I visit. And I guess it's that love of learning. You know, not every teacher, you'll be surprised, loves their job, but the vast majority are, you know, those true advocates of lifelong learners. And I think that's all I'm doing, is managing to use the technology, document it into a book, and share my passion for teaching and learning in a bite-sized format. And I think that's what maybe gives it its success.
And I think it does. And what is fantastic is the level of research in there, because as teachers, we're often told to question things ourselves and to understand why we're doing certain things. What I found fascinating, and I was looking for it, but I can't find the exact point in the book. But at some point in the book, you basically say that you were really given no formal training in questioning when you were doing teacher training. And I thought back to my teacher training. I thought, no, neither was I. And yet we are told that questioning in the classroom is absolutely vital. And yet we're not really told how to do it. And yet we ask many hundred questions a day.
Yeah, well, the research I unpicked, I think the quote was approximately 300 to 400 questions a teacher poses on a typical day, which, you know, when I discovered that, I thought, with all research, context is key. So you dig into what the research has actually gathered in terms of data, how the trials were conducted, in what context. So you dig into all those and you find what's relevant to pass on or share. So all the research always comes with a little bit of context. But, you know, if you just take a teacher that you know and you observe them all day, whether I'm asking you about, you know, how was your day yesterday? What are you having for dinner tonight? Did you see the news? What is the first planet in the solar system? If we're talking about subject-specific content, you can start to see how quickly, you know, that in the last 30 seconds, there's five or six questions I've posed already. So immediately we start to think about effectiveness, purpose, influence, that check for understanding, which is what teachers are trying to do on their feet every hour of the day to help gather data and move on with the lesson. So then actually it becomes quite an important thing to be really good at if it's the, you know, when behavior management becomes subtle and kind of subconscious and under the surface, so does our questioning too. But we all get, I've had a lot more behavior management CPD in my career as a teacher than I have on questioning, but a lot more safeguarding training in my career. So when we think about questioning, if that's the number one thing I'm doing as part of my verbal instructions every second of the day, then surely it should get a lot more, it should be a lot more front and center in terms of having some CPD attention. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to shine a light on it.
Now, I know that one of the most important pieces of research that you discovered was all about the power of the pause.
It is. So we're going to try and introduce some pauses here, aren't we? Yeah. I am a big fan of Mary Budd Rowe, and I think this is just one example of thousands and thousands of pieces of research that circulate on teacher Twitter or teacher X. Is it called X Twitter now or Edgy Twitter still? It's always changing, isn't it? But the power of the pause from Mary Budd Rowe. Here's a great example, actually. One of my colleagues 15 plus years ago used to call it a technique called pose, pause, pounce, bounce. Now, many people will have heard of this. I was writing for The Guardian at the time, and I worked with a teacher who called it this. And then I think there was a video online somewhere where Dylan William spoke about it in one of his video clips. And then I also put it in The Guardian. I think it got a bit of airtime and circulation. And even coming back to that technique today, 15 years later, That methodology is underpinned by Mary Budd Rowe's research on what she calls wait time as an instructional tool, so pausing as a teaching tool. So there's another good example of how things get lost in translation along the way. Lots of techniques that we all know and love or hate and use and then forget, but actually a very powerful tool that's underpinned by research but probably just needs resharing or re-highlighting. So if people not familiar with Mary Budd Rowe, she published a piece of research in 1972, which was called Wait Time. And it's a lovely piece of research. It's not too laborious or detailed to read, but essentially she highlights, you know, three or four key reasons as to why teachers should pause. The most obvious are kids are novices, so they're still learning new stuff. They're developing their motor skills, their verbal skills. Three, they need to learn to take a turn, so not call out, not shout out, because it interrupts everyone else's thought processes. But also they need time to process what's been said. So really obvious findings. But actually what she did was, you know, back in the 70s, she analyzed 300-plus tape recordings on the old cassettes, for those people that remember them. 300 recordings from classrooms, audio transcripts of teachers in classrooms posing questions. Now, if I had a lot more time in my life, you know, Mary Budd Rowe took 5 years to do this research. If I had a bit more time, one of my original goals was to try and log into teacher classroom participants as part of the research. There's lots of data already gathered in the book, but I wanted to log into the classrooms through a Zoom connection to hear the conversations in the classroom and probably maybe just choose to narrow things down, maybe the first 5 minutes of the lesson or the last 5 minutes, just to hear the frequency of questions posed in classrooms and how they're posed and what data it leads to. But, you know, ran out of time. But it kind of just highlights the importance of, you know, when we pose a question, what's the last planet in the solar system? That 3 second delay makes a big difference. Now, two key things that Mary Budd Rowe recommends, and I'll pause. One, she discovered most teachers pose a question and just wait up to 0.9 seconds before they demand an answer from their students. And what she found was the teachers that added the pause, and the optimum was approximately 3 to 5 seconds, that actually the teachers that waited had up to 300 to 700 increase in response rate compared to the teachers who just waited 0.9 seconds, which was the average and more common. So the message is, pose a question, what is the last planet in the solar system? Wait 3 seconds, and then you can do whatever method you want to do, you know, mini whiteboards or ask an individual. And then you're likely to have a better success rate, but that's underpinned by your behavior management. Don't call out, write it down on the whiteboard, you know, all those kind of methods. So, yeah, really, really important research.
And actually, when it comes to the methods within the book, you do say, be very, very clear with the young people about what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. You sort of, you make it very, very specific.
Yeah, I'm always a big fan of any teaching strategy works, but half the battle in classrooms is ensuring that kids understand the method or the technique being used. So if it's mini whiteboards, kids know why they've got one. They've got to know when to use the pen or when to use the board rubber. You've got to spend a lot of time investing in how to do that well, so that on the day, if I pop into your classroom and it's done brilliantly and automatically, there's lots of work. It's just like training to run down the 100-meter track. There's lots of work that's gone on behind the scenes to prepare your kids for the kind of the performance. So, you know, I won't get into observation discussion here, but it's like any technique. You train your kids how to use it. Why? Because it reduces your workload and improves the outcomes for your kids in terms of how they respond and look after one another, as well as collectively learn through the academic year. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of being really explicit in giving one or two examples, not all of them, of how best to implement a strategy using, you know, whatever technique is recommended.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to talk about mini whiteboards, because you know, within the book, within the questioning, you very much say about the mini whiteboards that I really like it. You ask the question, but the first thing they do isn't write the answer on the mini whiteboard. And I was like, oh, I remember, I was like, oh God, that's a really new thing. Now, I've been teaching for many years, like 20 plus here. And when I read that, I was like, wow, imagine having the whiteboard and the first thing is not writing the answer, but actually thinking about it.
Yeah. So it goes back to this kind of, you know, the importance of allowing kids that time to think. And then I guess that in your head, self-regulate what's right, what might be right, how to select. So I guess implicitly, there's a little bit of study skill development growing here. So I've got a great graphic that we can't obviously show in a podcast, but I'll include it in the kind of show notes so people can have a look at it. But what I've got is a kind of calendar that, if you imagine a timetable, and it's divided by months of the academic year, and then in each book, each chapter of the book, there is an explicit study skill technique that's listed. And what I try to do in the book is articulate as an example how each skill that's introduced on a month-by-month basis builds on the other. So if I can try and articulate the first 2 months of the year, let's say it's September, you've just met your students for the first time and you want to get them feeling confident, happy, and in a position where they're going to start to take risks, knowing that they'll get some answers wrong. So everybody has a mini whiteboard. You pose your questions. You get them to think about the answer. And then you maybe want them to scribble it down. And then you might want, all right, 3, 2, 1, show me on your mini whiteboard. You do that all month, as well as teaching them stuff. And then in October, you then introduce consciously as a strategy, think, pair, share. And then what we want to do here is, if I say again, what's the first planet in the solar system? Think first, don't call out. Now pair up with your friend and share what you think it might be. And then you're going to write it down. And then 3, 2, 1, show me. So you can see how I'm increasing the purpose of the whiteboards, but I'm introducing a new strategy, think, pair, share first. So let's double up your chances with somebody else and write it down. So the next technique would be bringing in wait time. So waiting 5 seconds before people do anything. And also a technique which I call funnel questions, which essentially start vague and go narrow, narrow, narrow. And again, when people look at this graphic through the recording, they'll be able to see how each technique builds on the other. So towards the end of the academic year, you're developing mastery question strategies as a teacher, but you're also educating your students how to respond to your questions. And while you're getting through the material, you're developing subtly behavior management, development of self-regulation, conference, relationships in class, and probably a lot more. So I'd encourage people to have a look at it. Remember, it's just my example. It's not the example. So if you're in a year one classroom, you'd have an entirely different grid. But maybe if you're teaching, you know, young adults, you know, A-level kind of age, you might have a more complex or a different range of question strategies.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. It really does, because I think often we start in September and we start teaching the children as we left the other children off in July. And we actually, what we need to do is we need to build up those strategies slowly, so actually they are embedded, as opposed to, oh, why can't you do this? The other class could. When actually you've given them a whole year of training. So yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, I've shared it in the chat box so you can see what I'm talking about, Corey, just briefly. But for people listening to this online, I'd encourage you to have a little look at it. Essentially, each technique I've put in a particular position to suit what I've written in the book. So obviously you don't need to follow what I've suggested here. And obviously age and subject and what they know, what they don't know will be of importance. But it's highlighting a range of new or familiar question strategies, and you'll probably have one or two that you're of your own to introduce. But when we get to the business end of the academic year, you know, April, May, June, towards exam season or moving into another year group, we start to push kids a little bit further with other question strategies you might find in adult scenarios, academic scenarios, online scenarios. So there's a whole range of things for people to take away and use in their own context.
That's amazing. Thank you. And yes, listeners, that will be in the show notes along with anything else that we chat about that is relevant. So I want to move on to something that I know is a real passion of yours, because you say it is in the book, and I've also heard you talk about it. But that basically is encode, store and retrieve. And why that is so important, because I'll be honest, okay, I was trained a while ago here. But when I was trained, like, there was absolutely no discussion about memory. There was no discussion about any sort of cognitive science stuff. We were just sort of told to teach the children. And actually, you talk about later on in the book about the art of teaching and then the science of teaching.
Well, if I talk about the art first, I guess, you know, I was of the same old school where you just got your qualifications and off you go. I mean, it was a lot deeper than that, but in a nutshell, off you go and learn from your experiences. So if I give you the finger wag, I can't do that on a podcast, but if I tell you off and shout down your ear, if I know that makes you shut up and makes you behave, that I learn from that experience and I use it again. So that's our experiences of teaching. I guess the science is your data analysis and those types of things. But I guess when we get into the cognitive science, that neuroeducation, which I guess why it's still new to us all is because the field of neuroeducation is only 40 years old. It's still a relatively new field, and even cognitive science isn't that established. So as all these ideas emerge and are used and tested in classrooms, we're starting to learn a lot more about how we actually learn and what myths to avoid and those kind of things. So the word retrieval, for 20, 30 years, I've used the word revision. It's exactly the same process. It's just cognitively the word used is retrieval. So the same for encode and store. Encode will be where I want to teach you stuff. So I might, you know, concepts, rules and facts. The storage is that schema. So that's the posh word we use for knowledge. So when we think about knowledge acquisition or knowledge activation, if I said tomato ketchup, straight away everyone listening is going to be thinking of red tomatoes, water, sugar, and how to make tomato ketchup. So then, you know, if I assume everyone listening here is at least 21 years old and has tasted ketchup before, then I can use that prior knowledge to pose a question: how would you make your ketchup taste spicy? Ooh. So then we get into the storage, and then I would retrieve it through a question. Give me the answer, write it down, show me, think, pair, share, those types of methods. So the encode, store, retrieve, excuse me, is just using the recommendations from cognitive science. And in my opinion, I now know, having taught myself this and read a lot of material from other teachers too, is blending the science recommendations with the art of my teaching experiences. And I think I'm a lot more effective than I've ever been in my entire career, because I feel more powerful because I'm using both. Yeah. a lot of cognitive scientists are academically gifted in that domain, but they have no teaching experience. Or some might work in a higher education context with adults who are quite happy to sit and behave and listen and learn and got that intrinsic motivation. But if I'm 7 years old and I've got a few things going on at home and I have to go into this primary classroom and learn maths period two and every Tuesday, then there's a different kind of factor taking place there that's the art of teaching about the motivations, the behavior management, all those kind of things that we learn works with a year seven pupil or whoever it might be. But there's also these science recommendations that we can use to guide us. I wouldn't say necessarily, let it dominate us, but it's very useful information to know that encode, store, retrieve methodology is a nice way to simplify, at least on paper, how learning happens.
Yeah, and I think that makes complete sense what you're saying about the questioning and how it links in and how actually you're building on children's existing schema by using the right questions. But actually, we need to get those questions right and we need to pose them in the right way.
Yeah, and I think it's important that all teachers, go to a lesson with one or two key planned questions. And in the book, I also unpick various strategies to kind of reduce that workload and improve your efficiency. But at the same time, I think I must have 20 or 30 different question techniques up my sleeve that I can use at any given point. So, we know the life of a teacher is very busy and we know we all accumulate wisdom over the years. But whether you're only teaching in your first year or 30th year, I think it's important, in the busy nature of all the things that we try to do, that if we think that we're posing 300 to 400 questions per day, then if I put you in the corner, how many different methods are you using other than just saying whatever comes out of your mouth? Yeah. What recommendations can we use from research, from cognitive science, as well as, whether we call it pose, pause, pounce, bounce, or think, pair, share, or cold call, or no opt out, whatever the technique's called, how do the principles work behind the scenes and what's the methodology that underpins it? So I think knowing at least consciously what they're called and how the techniques are used, I think it powers up the teacher pedagogy, in my opinion, and it allows a teacher to work a lot more efficiently.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned cold calling, and I have to be honest, when I hit that in the book, I was a bit like, oh my goodness, because I remember a job I had once where I had to cold call.
It's very Marmite.
So why include it if it is so Marmite?
So I think cold call gets a bad reputation for good and wrong reasons. A cold call will not work in a classroom where I've got no relationships, kids don't know me, and I don't really know what stuff they know or not. Now, if you imagine, let's just say I've got great relationships in place and great behavior management and my kids are enjoying being quizzed. Now, I've got to consider anxiety and well-being and all those factors. But I think what's important with the cold call methodology is it's not used there for a teacher to catch kids out. If I'm going 2 plus 2 and asking you for the answer, I'm wanting you to be successful. So there's different ways I can do that. Write it down in the whiteboard. Let's go a little bit slower. Let's build that confidence. But if we're wanting a bit like what we see on the TV, where we see lots of celebrities and so on and so forth doing online general knowledge quizzes or face-to-face and game shows, then we can see the benefits of when we quiz people, it activates our neurons. Give me 3 ingredients that's used in tomato ketchup. So when we think about the classroom dynamics, whether you're getting kids to stand up or sit down and you're giving them only that, cold call, at least the demonstrations I tend to see, fall into that trap of just waiting 1 second. So I think to improve student success, which has got to be the ultimate goal of any teacher strategy, is let's follow some research. Let's use cold call, yes, but let's manage kids' well-being and anxiety. Let's introduce a pause. Because they're not going to be doing a speed test, although in some respects they are when they do the final exam, they'll only have a limited amount of time to complete it. But in the grand scheme of things, by giving them 3 seconds rather than 1 second won't make a big difference when they're trying to complete, 20 or 30 questions in an exam paper. So cold call, for me, is a Marmite reputation, a Marmite strategy that gets a bad reputation. But I do think in some contexts, using specific principles, it can be used for good. I think where it might be lost is when it's an enforced strategy, when kids have to respond regardless. There's obviously that other technique called no opt out, which is the, you know, I'm not going to accept that you say don't know, or, you know, a kind of blank response. So a recommendation there is to move around the classroom and get the student to practice saying the correct answer. I think with everything, context is key. You know, you want your teachers to nurture students to not increase stress, because when we increase stress, we weaken retrieval. So it's important that that teachers try their best to reduce the stress to increase retrieval strength. So a good example that I use in my last book, Guide to Memory, was if you have a flat tire, it's stressful. If it happens before work, you can get a cab if you need to. You can get the spanner out of your workshop in your garage or under the stairs. You can call the AA or somebody if you want to. But you might be able to fix the flat tire. But if we take that same scenario and put you on the hard shoulder of a motorway, it's the same problem, but you're in a different context. Yeah. You're on the hard shoulder, you're more likely to get injured. It's a bit stressful. You're away from home. You don't have all the tools to hand. So the stress is much higher. That your ability to then retrieve and fix that problem is significantly weaker. So no different to the classroom in terms of how we pose, how we pause, techniques we use, and managing. You know, let's face it, our kids are novices. They're not experts. So they've got a growing cognitive ability compared to us. And it's important that we are aware of these things in the complex nature of what, you know, the classroom.
Yeah. You talk in the book about the questioning culture and making sure the questioning culture is right. And I actually wrote down two four words that came up with trust, safe, welcoming, and encouraging. And I was thinking, yeah, because actually, if I'm in that sort of environment where there is trust and I feel safe and it is welcoming and it is encouraging, then I'm more likely to give an answer than if I feel I'm going to be jumped on if I give the wrong answer.
Absolutely. I mean, routines are probably the most important thing you can give a child. You know, some of our kids don't have routines at home. Some of the, you know, they come to school expecting them, but, you know, schools are complex places. They'll have different teachers someday. The timetable's changed. And then they've got to go to a different classroom in a secondary school. Or you know, where you mentioned, you know, special educational needs. Yeah. You know, if I've got ADHD or autism or whatever it might be, I'm not kind of fitting the average mold. So, you know, our teachers work hard to try and understand complex learning needs and the wide raft of those in our classrooms. I guess all teachers would recognize the importance of trust. You know, you mentioned safe and welcoming and encouraging environments. I think once you've got those in place and teachers working exclusively, you know, week on week throughout the academic year, to really bring out the best in their young people, they can then get to a place where they can start to, through routines and personalities and those kind of factors, really start to increase the stakes. So as you develop that confidence, you can increase the stress in some degree. So a simple example would be, if I asked you again, give me four ingredients for tomato ketchup, then I've increased the stress slightly by moving it from three to four. But then to really increase the stress, I say you've only got 5 seconds to give me an answer. So that time factor really increases the stress and it could weaken the retrieval. So throughout the academic year, we can start to see why cold call might be a really good strategy to use later in the year once relationships are established. Because we've spent a long time boosting kids' retrievals to the point where if I go 2 plus 2 or 3 times 3 or 4 minus 2, whatever the questions are, used frequently to activate and boost that retention, you can start to see how kids can, what might have taken them 30 seconds in the beginning, they can now respond in less than 2. So, you know, context is key with everything, really.
Yeah, and that matrix makes so much more sense in building up that questioning culture. It really does. And I put in mind of when I first started using lollipop sticks many, many, many years ago. And culture wasn't even mentioned. It was like, right, all the children's names on lollipop sticks, ask questions, pull them out and ask the question. And these children would look terrified You know, they, and you can see them praying, please God, don't let it be my lollipop stick. Actually, what wasn't there is that stuff that you're talking about, actually the training, the culture, the helping them to feel safe within that environment so actually they didn't feel terrified of questions being answered and potentially not knowing the answer. And I think, goodness, it's really interesting the way sometimes we put the cart before the horse with teaching, and clearly that was a cart.
I guess at the time it was a good, you know, in a different era of education quality stroke evaluation, observers might have been wanting to check that teachers were asking all kids a question. You know, I think years on now, if I pose a question in the room, then all kids could or could not be listening to the question, depends on how we want to frame it. But again, going back to mini whiteboards or, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, whatever method, there's other ways that you can check and seek a higher success rate. So I think that there's the message here that if I pose one question, whether I use a lolly stick method to give to pull Toria's name out of the cup or not, it's moving away from that kind of one-off instance where it's not so efficient compared to if I pose the question, what is the third planet in the solar system? We'll all know the planet phone this podcast. if I pose the question, what's the third planet? And I insist that everyone has to respond, which is a bit of a no opt-out methodology. If I then chose Toria, then that's a cold call methodology. But I would much rather make concrete that everybody has at least thought about the question. So that's hence why the mini whiteboards comes in. Write down the answer, whether you get it right or wrong. Show me, prove to me that you have thought. So I don't use the phrase think, pair, share. I prefer the think, pair, share, show me as a methodology. As a phrase. So think, pair, share, show me you've thought about it. And then I've got, you know, whether half my class get it wrong, at least I've increased from one person to all the class responding. And for teacher workload, that's got to be your default method for working, because you're activating all that thought process in all your students rather than one. And let's face it, when we pose a question to one student, the rest of the class switch off. And one thing worth mentioning is nobody expects two questions in a row. So it's another very subtle and important technique to consider, that when you are doing a one-to-one question scenario and you're moving around the classroom, for example, it's often worth just coming back to the same person again, because they don't necessarily expect to get two questions in a row. We often think when we answer it, oh, we'll move away. So again, it's another great little strategy to consider, two in sequence as a question method.
I really like that idea.
Because it gives keeping people on their toes, keeping their activation going. I use it in my teacher training sessions. It works a treat. You can really see, even as adults, we do it too. We switch off after we've answered that one question.
And actually, you talk about using these questioning techniques with adults in CPD. And I think that's really useful, because often we need to see something in action in order to actually then carry it forward into our teaching.
Yeah, so the last few chapters of the book, one chapter is exclusively written for teacher training scenarios. So, for example, if you're having your next inset day or twilight, whatever it might be, you know, if it was on questioning, what would the session look like, first of all? But then if we think about, you know, a longer-term kind of shift in the culture across the organization, not just in classrooms but in teacher training, to develop a love of learning for all staff across the school, maybe we could start every staff briefing or every assembly or every teacher training session with a question. And then we start to unpick different questioning formats, different question influences, and we can start to get to a place where we're posing lots of supportive and challenging stroke provocative questions to want to be a better institution in terms of the learning environment. So that's one idea that's taken for adults in another kind of deeper context. There's two more. One is also on leadership. So often when teachers move up the ladder, it's either through opportunity, you know, will and desire, or maybe talent, or maybe there's no one else for the job, whatever it would be. But we often never get any training prior to taking on that responsibility. So we often kind of spend the first term or two kind of fake it till we make it, learning from mistakes till we get to a point of confidence. And then come the second academic year when we're in a role, we feel a lot more confident to ask those difficult questions. So I guess it's just one there for all teachers, but particularly middle leaders and senior leaders. What question and methods can we use to bring out the best in others to get off to a good start, I suppose? You know, I think about my own leadership career. Maybe I didn't ask those punchy questions from the very start because I was maybe not so confident with line managing an English department, being design and technology trained, for example. The last idea for adults is stuff that I've learned from my academic studies. How to approach anything, I suppose, but let me just maybe narrow it down. It's too vague. How to approach school improvement with an academic lens. So if I was a researcher coming into your classroom to observe you ask questions, what methods and techniques does a researcher use to narrow down their perspective? So a lot of the things that I've learned from not just question techniques, but also strategies to use as a researcher to really zoom in on something pinprick specific allows you to then evaluate it much more reliably. You know, our life as school leaders, we run around classrooms with observation checklists. We try to see everything that's going on. We ask you, how do you think it went? And we give you, and then we kind of make up a bit of feedback for the next 30 minutes. When actually, if I said, as a focus, I want you to come into my classroom and look at the first 3 minutes only about how I settle the class down to work, that's a lot more a lot more laser sharp there. So if I then want to say, what questions do I ask in those first 3 minutes, then we're starting to get into a pedagogical technique as well as a behavior management technique. So I guess the message there is, how can you use questions to sharpen your focus when you're trying to evaluate performance in other adults?
Yeah.
So that's the last chapter of the book.
And in case you haven't figured it out, listeners, I absolutely loved the book. I really did. And what I also loved is the way it was put together, because in each chapter, you've got an explainer, a practical idea, a worked example, and a template. And it all sort of makes lots of sense, because what I found was that sometimes I'd read the explainer and I was like, oh, I'm not quite sure what that looks like. And as a teacher, I like to know what it looks like. And that was why it was so useful, having the practical idea, the worked example, and then, of course, the template that I can then go away with and actually think about how I'm going to use it. And as I've already said, there are lots of QR codes. There are QR codes to videos, QR codes to all sorts of really useful things.
Yeah, no, there's tons of stuff in there. So I've tried to break it down for primary colleagues, secondary, based on my experiences and people working in FE, and even online. So we're doing this online recording. So, you know, what questions work best in an online context, having all lived through the pandemic, something else to consider.
I thought that was a really apt chapter, because we often forget about the online world now that we're back in schools. But who's to say that we won't be back online again?
Yeah. But I mean, even still, you know, we're in an online setting now. Yeah. We're recording this. We've asked lots of questions. We'll be maybe recording a video for our children to watch for a piece of homework, and we might pose a question ready for the next lesson. So there are certain techniques you can use. One thing I've learned about is lecture pauses, doing it online, or there's something called the gaze. And obviously people can't see me doing this online, but, you know, there's tons of research. But in chapter 6 in the book, we can maybe put a summary in some of the show notes for people, lots of the QR codes. But there is, what I discovered in the pandemic writing about this was, there's actually loads and loads of already published research about what works well in an online context. So if we think about MOOCs, which are these online Moodle bits of software, or you might log into Blackboard if you're doing a university degree, all these online platforms. I'm trying to think of all the different names now, Moodles and Doodles and all those kind of things, all these clunky VLEs that we use. There's loads of research out there about what works well in an online setting. You know, 30, 40 years now online since the internet, and there's loads of students learning outside of the school system in online scenarios. So what works in those contexts? So pandemic or not, it's something for us all to consider. You know, no one's going to be turning the internet off anytime soon. So we need to think about how they might work in the future of education or schooling if we ever switch to a 4-day working week, or we have the next snow day and we've all got to teach online at home, how are you going to pose your questions online?
Yeah. No, I thought that was a brilliant chapter to have in there. So final question in the book was, what are you going to do with this book? And do you know what? I have so many ideas about things that I want to change. But what I've taken away from this conversation with you is it's not about doing a complete 180. It's mm-hmm. about ensuring that the things I change well. And I'm going to start using the matrix. Yes. And I'm going to do a much better job of using my mini whiteboards. So before I let you go, yes. Ross, I need to ask you my final question. And I've given you loads of time now to think about an answer.
It was a good question.
So my final question is this. If you could have been taught by anyone, living or dead, who would have been your perfect teacher?
Well, my answer is a chap called Paul Boldy, and he's surname spelled B-O-L-D-Y, and he's still alive, and he's actually the person that encouraged me to be a teacher. And I think about the qualities that he had that inspired me to become a teacher was because, you know, it was relatable. You obviously get those kind of subject connections that you bring, the teacher brings out the best in your discipline or your interests. There's always a bit of comedy in there. There's always the kind of moments of crisis where you've got something going on at home and you have that listening ear. There's also the, preparedness, I suppose, I want of a better word. Mm-hmm. So when he knew that I wanted to go off to be a teacher, you know, they set up mock interviews for me, you know, mock scenarios in my sixth. He even got me teaching his year seven class for a year. So I was teaching when I was 18.
Wow.
So I guess it was just meant to be. I guess for him, it was a workload fix. Get Ross to teach my class and I'll just sit back and have some time off. So I absolutely loved it. And it allowed me to really know that I wanted to go off and do a 4-year B.Ed back in the day and go 200 miles from, you know, Lancashire down to London to train to be a teacher. And then I never left. So it was obviously the thing that was meant to be. So that's the person I'd still probably want to teach me today. And I think Paul, he's over in kind of Chorley Way, Lancashire. And I know he follows me on Instagram, so I'll put the link out and I'll see if he listens to this.
Oh, fingers crossed. And he would be a perfect addition to the Tiny Voice Talks school. Yes. He really would.
Pick his brains, he will.
Thank you so much, Ross, for coming on and chatting to me all about questioning. I have learned so much. Love the book. Love chatting to you. And yeah, it's been a great bit of time spent.
Yeah, thank you for having me. A world exclusive. You're the only one.
Yay! Go us, Tiny Voice Talks.
Yeah, great channel. I hope everyone enjoys the show.